we lived up to our end of the bargain. So no, first and foremost, we need to be paid what we're owed.
Oil companies and lawmakers are preparing for another fight over the state's oil and gas tax credit system. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, December 22nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, facing fewer positions and a tight budget, state troopers say they may have to pull out of urban areas.
We're at a breaking point right now, providing the amount of services that we're required to do statewide.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their homes. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT now or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message brought to you by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
When Governor Bill Walker released his state budget last week, the phrase oil and gas tax credits was noticeably absent from the announcement. But that doesn't mean it won't be a hot topic this year. Lawmakers in the new House Democratic majority say the current oil and gas tax credit structure is unsustainable, and they're working on a bill to change it. As Elizabeth Harbaugh from Alaska's Energy Desk reports, the oil industry is trying to keep the tax credits alive, but it's not going to be an easy fight.
When it comes to oil tax credits, Jim Musselman says he feels like a character from the Sunday comics.
Lucy's holding the football for Linus to kick it.
For peanut sticklers out there, he means Charlie Brown.
She pulls it back, and she does it time and again, and poor Linus keeps trying to kick it, and she keeps pulling it back. It's kind of the way we feel. We kind of feel like we're Linus.
Lucy, in this analogy, is the state of Alaska. Musselman, as Charlie Brown, leads the oil company Kalis Energy. Kalis estimates it will have earned close to $200 million in tax credits by spring. But last summer, citing the state's budget crisis, Governor Walker vetoed $430 million in oil tax credits. Musselman says the promise of those credits was a big reason why a small company like Kalis came to Alaska to explore for oil, which is exactly what the current tax credit system was designed to do, given the dwindling flow of oil down the pipeline. And this fall, Kalis announced it has found 2 billion barrels of oil in waters off the North Slope. Musselman says Kalis needs those credits to help them move forward.
We lived up to our end of the bargain, so no, first and foremost, we need to be paid what we're owed.
But that may not happen anytime soon. When Governor Walker released next year's budget, he appropriated the statutory minimum, $74 million, to pay back oil tax credits. All told, the state estimates it will owe oil companies about $650 million by June. The governor's position is the state needs to pay off the credits companies earned. Eventually. But Alaska needs to solve its budget problem first. Brad Keithley, president of Alaskans for Sustainable Budgets, says the state should ask itself 2 questions when it thinks about whether to keep letting oil companies earn credits.
One is, do we really need to have that sort of reimbursable tax structure to make these projects go forward? Is that really necessary? And the second one, and frankly the one I focus on a lot, is whether it's a good deal for Alaskans.
Keithley says for something like Kalis's Smith Bay development, the state could be on the hook for billions of dollars in tax credits before any oil is produced. And he says Kalis's big oil find is promising, but not 100%. That means there's a chance all the money due in tax credits won't result in more oil in the pipeline. Some lawmakers agree with Keithley. They think the state can't afford to promise credits to companies any longer.
We know that we want to keep the industry active, but also we can't be cutting essential services or taking PFDs, you know, to pay off unsustainable credits.
That's Democratic Representative Garen Tarr, incoming co-chair of the House Resources Committee. Tarr says the governor may introduce legislation to change the oil and gas tax credit system. But House Democrats like her are also working on their own bill to retool the credits. Neither bill will just slip by Republican lawmakers. Kathy Geisel, who chairs the Senate Natural Resources Committee, says the fact that Alaska isn't paying back credits that oil companies earned is bad for the state's economy.
Fundamentally, we are viewed as an unstable regime in the world because we keep changing our tax policy. So it's going to have to be a pretty solid case for me to even consider yet again another change.
Giesel won't say she'll reject any proposal House Democrats come up with, but she won't easily be convinced. She says the state already phased out some oil and gas credits in the last legislative session. In other words, Republicans plan on asking tough questions before the oil and gas tax credit football is yanked away for good. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
After two eruptions in as many days, scientists are closely watching a volcano in the eastern Aleutians. There's no equipment on Bogoslav Volcano, but the Alaska Volcano Observatory is keeping tabs with satellite imagery and nearby seismic monitors. KUCB's Zoe Sobel has more on Bogoslav's eruption.
Bogoslav Volcano is tiny, like City Park tiny. The uninhabited island is less than a quarter of the size of Central Park in New York City. Michelle Coombs, a scientist with the Alaska Volcano Observatory, says the recent Bogoslav eruptions have produced some new land.
We have new observations from today that suggest that the new vent is just offshore of the little island and has destroyed part of Bogoslav Island, but also produced new land.
But she says because the new vent is underwater, interpreting seismic activity is more difficult. Typically, when there's an eruption, seismic waves move through the ground. With underwater vents, scientists get two sets of waves, the expected waves moving through the ground and another set of distorted waves that travel through the water. At this point, Coombs says it's hard to predict how much longer the Bogoslav eruption will last.
I wish we had a crystal ball and could say the exact sequence. We definitely don't have that capability. We're also even more limited in this situation because it's such a small island. We do not have any local seismic monitoring instruments on the island.
Based on past eruptions on the island, Bogoslav could be active for weeks or even months. In Unalaska, I'm Zoe Sobel.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a room without a view for inmates in protective custody. What constitutes outdoor recreation?
You try to get what sun rays you can that sometimes shines just perfectly.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 directory for older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
This week, Governor Bill Walker released his version of next year's budget, and Girdwood contracted with Whittier for police protection. But as Alaska Public Media's Ellen Lockyer reports, the seemingly unrelated events may give insight into changes to come for law enforcement in other parts of the state.
On Wednesday, the city of Anchorage finalized a 3-year contract with the tiny city of Whittier to provide police officers for Girdwood. The ski resort town is Anchorage's southernmost suburb and until recently was policed by Alaska State Troopers. Girdwood was left without law enforcement when the trooper post there closed this summer, so a Girdwood Public Safety Committee hammered out the cop-sharing scheme with Whittier, paid for by Girdwood taxpayers. Chair Sam Daniel.
To my knowledge, this relationship has not existed anywhere else in Alaska that I know of. But in these times of fiscal restraint, may end up being a trend if the troopers keep having their budget cut.
Daniel says the cooperative policing arrangement may be a first, but it may not be the last. Alaska State Trooper Director Colonel James Cockrell says the troopers' division faces a budget decrease next year.
We're at a breaking point right now, providing the amount of services that we're required to do statewide, and we're not meeting those core functions of our division. And we're struggling to keep up with the calls in the Matsu Valley, the YK Delta, with all the sexual assaults and domestic violence. We're not keeping up with that. And then you look at our Fairbanks area and elsewhere in the state, we're not keeping up with the amount of calls.
If the governor's budget passes, it will mean the trooper division has absorbed $10 million in budget cuts over 3 years. Cockrell says the end result is a reduction in trooper manpower.
We've lost 32 trooper positions in 2 years. No time in the history of the Alaska State Troopers have we lost that many positions in such short time.
Cockrell says the Girdwood Post was closed because reductions in manpower forced the trooper division to redeploy the Girdwood troopers to the Kenai Peninsula cities of Seward and Soldotna. Governor Walker's proposed fiscal year 2018 budget has a little more money in it for the Public Safety Department, but the boost is misleading because the increase is restricted to use by the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. Alaska leads the nation in sexual assault and domestic violence per capita. Cockrell says his division has to balance fewer troopers with an escalation in the amount of calls the division gets.
If you look at crime in Alaska, it's on an uptick. And not even the small crimes, but the seriousness of the crimes are climbing. And our assaults on our police officers are growing. And we're asking our troopers to go and handle domestic violences with one person. There's no other police department in the United States that would only send one police officer to an ongoing domestic violence, and we do that routinely. We routinely go out to the villages to handle gun calls with one or two troopers. Anywhere else in the country, they would send a SWAT team. We're doing it with two troopers.
With a state legislature bent on further budget reductions, yet offering little in the way of solutions, Cockrell says there are bound to be further trooper post shutdowns. Talkeetna's post has already closed, while Haines's is slated to lose one trooper position. As to further changes on the horizon, Cockrell says the troopers are primarily charged with service to Alaska's outlying areas, not to its cities.
I think at some point in time, that's going to have to be looked at, just like we're trying to get out of the municipality of Anchorage where they have police powers, is to move the troopers out of urban areas and just focus on our rural areas where we have a long tradition of providing police services.
He says some organized boroughs are getting trooper enforcement for free, and that may have to end. He points specifically to the Matanuska-Susitna borough, an area the size of West Virginia with no law enforcement beyond the small city police forces in Palmer and Wasilla. Cockrell says the Matsu is now an urban area, and if it wants more law enforcement, residents there may have to find a way to start paying for it. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
In many correctional facilities in Alaska, an enclosed room with an opening that lets in fresh air is considered outdoor space. For inmates held in protective custody at Goose Creek Correctional Center in Wasilla, that's their only access to outdoor recreation. And that could be a violation of their constitutional rights. Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman toured the facility.
Jimmy Nix sits in a small white room at Goose Creek, the only splash of color from his blazing orange prison uniform. Since June of 2015, he's been housed in the Special Management Unit, or the SMU. He sought protective custody because he's a convicted sex offender, a crime that often elicits threats and punishments from general population inmates.
There were a lot of taunting, a lot of things being said, you know, kill yourself.
Inmates in the SMU live, eat, and recreate in a completely separate area of the prison from other inmates. It's for their own safety, but it comes with restrictions. They have limited access to education programs and are only allowed out of their cells a few hours a day. Their outdoor recreation area is a large enclosed cement room with a roof and one opening at the top of a wall that lets in fresh air.
The part where you get locked down in your room, I mean, it takes its toll on you already. But the part where you can't go outside, see a sunshine, see a tree, watch a bird, it's very depressing. It weighs on you.
Nick says they can only see sky, clouds, and the occasional plane. Some inmates in the SMU say they haven't seen trees or grass in over a year.
You try to get what sun rays you can that sometimes shines just perfectly. You'll see about eight guys conjure up in a little bitty square to just absorb the sunshine from the grates, because there's not much that comes through.
Department of Corrections policy says allowing the inmates access to the space meets their requirements for daily outdoor recreation. Goose Creek Superintendent John Conant leads me into the room.
So this is considered outdoor recreation?
Yes, it is. Yeah, outside, inside, that's what I've always been told, yeah.
What makes this outdoor recreation?
Because of the fresh air. That's the main thing.
The room has exercise equipment in one area and a basketball hoop. inmates in the general population have access to an open yard with ball fields, grass, and views of trees. They also can go to indoor gymnasiums. Conant and Assistant Superintendent Kevin Horton walk through the open yard, explaining the values of outdoor recreation.
The more they're out recreating and out of the mods and blowing off steam, the better things are throughout the whole institution. So.
But Horton says they can't make the yard available to people in protective custody because they have to keep the group separate. He says if the staff mix them together, they can't guarantee the prisoner's safety. And moving the 120 SMU inmates is logistically challenging in a prison that holds about 1,200 people. He walks inside to the gym.
We can't shut down the yard to move that population into a general population area, because then we're losing time, we're interrupting programs, we're interrupting jobs, and things of that nature.
Conant stresses that the guys in protective custody have voluntarily chosen to be there. They could transfer to other special general population units that are considered safer. He opens the door to one such area.
There's other units these guys can be in if they just have a little more courage, I guess you'd say, and just try it.
But Tara Rich with the ACLU of Alaska says just because the inmates volunteer to be in the SMU does not mean that they waive their Eighth Amendment rights. That amendment protects them from cruel and unusual punishment and includes regular access to the outdoors. DOC policy says the SMU inmates' rights are being met by letting them spend time in the room with fresh air. But Rich says case law doesn't support that assertion.
I have not seen any sort of guarantee that for Eighth Amendment purposes, an open window in an enclosed room would be equivalent to guaranteeing a meaningful opportunity for outdoor exercise.
Inmates in the SMU, like Clayton Allison, agree and say the deprivation has taken its toll. He says he's only seen nature once in the past year and a half, at his mother's funeral last summer.
I unashamedly admit that I was weeping on the ride there, not because of my mom's death, but because of the car ride and the being able to be outside. I was able to see all the many colors of the green on the trees and the flowers, and it had been so long, it was just overwhelming for me.
Allison says just being able to see the grass could greatly improve his mental health. Superintendent Condon says protective custody inmates will only have access to the open yard if there's a departmental policy change. Rich says the ACLU is working with the DOC to try to improve conditions for inmates who are in all types of segregation, including the SMU. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, fueling philanthropic programs dedicated to creating educational and professional opportunities for Alaska Native people. Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by
GCI, keeping Alaskans connected to live the life they choose. GCI is an Alaska-born and raised telecommunications company and a proud supporter of Alaska Public Media.
Alaska and British Columbia are working out details of how they will handle transboundary mine concerns. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports on the effort to coordinate monitoring and permitting on both sides of the border.
A statement of cooperation between the state and the province signed in early October promises openness, transparency, and increased environmental monitoring. Now begins the work of meeting those goals. Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott heads up the state's effort to address concerns about British Columbia mines near rivers that flow into southeast Alaska. He says state and provincial officials met via teleconference December 16th.
We're trying to create a big tent here, but with a very specific process of engagement and sharing and review and critical examination of all of those things that we need to.
The state's Department of Environmental Conservation will address water quality concerns. Terry Lomax is a manager in the agency's monitoring and assessment program.
We, of course, can do our testing on the Alaskan side, and we're hoping our BC counterparts can do testing on the British Columbia side, but that hasn't been determined yet.
Testing will create a record of what's in transboundary river water now, with an eye toward changes that could threaten fisheries, wildlife, and people.
Some of the groups that are already doing monitoring, they're collecting water and sediment contaminants of concerns, specifically like trace metals. That kind of information is going to really help us in deciding how to narrow down our focus and really kind of, you know, how to pick the right parameters and methods to be looking at.
Those other groups include tribal governments in Southeast Alaska and Northwest British Columbia. They'll be asked to help develop the region-wide monitoring program. Other state agencies will work on protocols for input into BC's permitting process. Malotte says the state will also develop a website to share more information about transboundary mines.
You can never say nothing will drop through the cracks, but at least we will have a process and a working relationship that is stronger and more focused and with a value construct that did not exist before.
The state's efforts accelerated last year. That came after environmental, fisheries, tribal, and community leaders pushed for active engagement with BC leaders. One mine, the Red Chris, began operations in the Stikine River watershed in 2015. Another, the Tulsiqua Chief, is closed and leaking pollutants into the Taku watershed. A half dozen to a dozen others are being explored and considered for development. Guy Archibald works with Inside Passage Waterkeeper and the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council.
I think the process itself is helping make things safe. You know, anytime Alaska and BC can communicate these projects to each other and ask for expertise, I think is constructive.
Other mine critics say the state's agreement with BC needs to go further. Fisheries business owner Heather Hartcastle is with the group Salmon Beyond Borders.
We would like to see enforceable protections and financial assurances that we will not be negatively impacted by upstream mining in British Columbia. And I still don't see how the state of Alaska is pushing for those.
In a prepared statement, British Columbia officials say the province will share equal responsibilities under the agreement. That includes water quality monitoring on their side of the border. They say tribal governments called First Nations in Canada will participate, as will the mining industry. I'm Ed Schoenfeld, reporting in Juneau.
Alaska's Republican U.S. senators support investigating Russian meddling in this year's presidential election. Senator Lisa Murkowski said the Senate should investigate, citing a need for a thorough, transparent review. A spokesman for Senator Dan Sullivan says Sullivan supports Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's position that an inquiry can occur through the existing committee structure. Sullivan wants the Senate to review U.S. cyber defenses as part of a broader discussion. He says he doesn't want any investigation used as a tool to delegitimize the outcome of the election won by Republican Donald Trump. CIA Director John Brennan has said the intelligence community is in agreement that Russia tried to interfere in the election, although there's no evidence Moscow succeeded in helping Trump win. When new members of Congress take the oath of office on January 3rd, Alaska Senator Dan Sullivan will give up an unsought distinction. He'll no longer be last in Senate seniority, number 100 out of 100. APRN's Liz Ruskin asked him about his year and about being the most junior of junior senators.
Seniority is a big deal in the Senate. It can determine where your office is, which committees you sit on, and often when you get to speak at a hearing. Sullivan says it didn't bother him being dead last.
You know, makes things easy. I didn't have to figure out where my desk on the floor was going to be. I didn't have to figure out what my office was going to be. By the time you're number 100, most choices were made for you.
In 2017, he'll be 93 on the seniority list and 92 if Senator Jeff Sessions resigns to become Attorney General. In a way, Sullivan says he actively worked to keep himself low in the pecking order by spending a lot of time this year campaigning for his fellow GOP senators.
The fact that I'm not going to be moving up much in terms of seniority is fine with me, because that means we were successful in keeping the Senate in our in Republican control.
He also raised money for Republican candidates through his leadership PAC, True North Political Action Committee. Members of Congress have leadership PACs to raise money for their colleagues and often their party. Federal records show True North raised and spent more than $400,000 over the past 2 years. Sullivan claims multiple accomplishments for the year. The one that seemed to be the longest shot was convincing the Army to reconsider downsizing a brigade combat team at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. Sullivan, a reserve officer in the Marines, worked his position on the Senate Armed Services Committee.
Probably the number one thing I focused on in the past year and a half was making sure the Army doesn't take troops out. So we've made good progress on the 425, keeping that.
In the final hours of the session this month, Congress passed a water resources bill. It advances work on harbors across Alaska. Sullivan says he authored a section that will send $300 million over 5 years to small communities that lack basic water and sewer service.
The numbers got cut down, which wasn't great, but that made it.
He'd originally asked for five times as much. Sullivan says he also took on a new cause.
Then you kind of learn things. So the other thing that hopefully you've seen, I mean, I like in this job, woke up to the issue of the drug abuse and opioid abuse and heroin overdoses.
Sullivan convened a summit on the topic in Palmer this summer, and he says he's pleased Congress passed two anti-drug bills.
The 21st Century Cures has $1 billion for opioid treatment that hopefully Alaska is going to see a significant amount of that.
Even with the lowest seniority in the Senate, Sullivan says he got key committee assignments for Alaska. He'll keep them in the new Congress, but he just might upgrade to a better office suite. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Zoe Sobel in Unalaska, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., and Elizabeth Harbaugh, Ann Hillman, and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
And by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. If you have an opinionated teenager in your home who thrives on proving a point, check out the Debating Alaska's Fiscal Future Scholarship Competition organized by UAA's Seawolf Debate Program. More than $10,000 in prizes will be awarded. Debating Alaska's Fiscal Future gives the next generation of Alaskans a voice in the direction of our state. Contest details available at debatingakfuture.com. This message sponsored by Seawolf Debate.
The Alaska Public Radio Network builds bridges of communication between urban and rural Alaska. APRN, covering the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.